My name's Jonathan Lynn, and I directed My Cousin Vinny in 1990 or 91. God, I should know that, shouldn't I? Fox approached me about doing the film. I'd just done a British film that they'd released very successfully called Nuns on the Run. And it had gone well here. And they had this project that it seemed nobody else really wanted to direct, which was very lucky for me. And I fell in love with the script when I read it. They suggested Joe Pesci, and so we were up and running after the usual legal delays. And although it says entering Alabama there, we in fact shot the film in Georgia. Atlanta is in Georgia, and is a film center. There's some equipment there, and so it was just a little easier. Alabama doesn't really have much filming, and so it would have been more expensive to shoot it there. There's opening sequence, signs like dirt for sale, and this sign here, free horse manure. These weren't in the script, but I saw these when I was driving around location scouting, and I thought it added a little texture. And this opening sequence is, of course, designed to be the two boys, played by Ralph Macchio and Mitchell Whitfield, driving into the small town where the whole movie takes place. And this is, as you can see, a very picturesque title sequence. The title song is by Travis Tritt. I think he had a song like this already, but he changed the lyrics for us. This shot here of the dog, we didn't have a trained dog. The film was made on a shoestring. We had a lot of trouble getting it to look in the direction of the car. And then I put some food on the other side of the road, and after that there was no problem. He just stared at the food. This little convenience store is pretty much the way we found it on our location scout, except we changed the name outside.
Don't they have any generics here?
I think this is the generic.
I never heard of that brand. Maybe we should get this one. Maybe
and apart from the courtroom, virtually everything in the film was shot on location. It wasn't a very expensive movie, and that was a cheaper way to go. Also, it had more authenticity.
Well, I'm getting it for myself.
One burrito and one large slush. $21.67.
Can you fill this up? $21.67.
This crane shot, which shows the boys driving away from the convenience store, actually reveals all the houses that witnesses live in, those two houses across the street. And then as the camera cranes up, there's another house which you can see over the sign, Sack of Suds, in the distance behind those trees. And so when all the eyewitnesses to the murder are questioned in court, we have in fact already established, without the audience realizing it, we've established their relationship to the Sack of Suds store.
Down here. You know what the minimum age for execution is in Alabama?
What, 16?
10. 10.
There's a cop behind us.
A cop?
There's nothing to worry about, right?
There might be.
There's nothing to worry about until there's something to worry about. Just relax, please.
Is he still there?
Yeah.
Damn it.
Just calm down. All right? There's a cop behind us, that's all. There's nothing wrong. There's no problem.
I was very eager to have Ralph Macchio in the movie. I had never actually seen, I have to confess, I'd never actually seen The Karate Kid. I watched him on a couple of videos. as his agent says, and I thought he was just perfect for the part. He's Italian, he's New York, he's sympathetic, he's likable, he's very good in the movie.
Show me your hands!
Mitchell Whitfield was an actor who I think was new to movies. But he had a very good feel for the part.
Out of the car!
Go!
Yeah, I'm sure it's number 3 and 5.
Ridiculous, all this over a can of tuna.
Quiet!
And now for the first time here we discover that there's actually been a murder. There's Bruce McGill as the sheriff. And this scene was shot handheld, with a handheld camera, as were some other scenes in the picture, carefully chosen for that reason. The audience doesn't really notice that it's handheld, but there is a subliminal sort of documentary, newsy feel about a handheld camera that you don't have with the camera on a dolly.
Hello, Bill. I'm Sheriff Farley.
Hi.
You know why you're here?
Yeah, I do. I'm sorry. It was a stupid thing to do.
Have you been made aware of your rights?
Yes.
You're willing to waive that right?
Yes. I'm willing to cooperate fully. I'll sign a statement or whatever makes this whole thing easier.
Good. That's good.
But I want you to know, Stan, he had nothing to do with it.
Did he help you plan it?
No. I mean, it wasn't planned out. You know, just like, you know, it just happened.
Did Stan try to stop you at any time?
No. I mean, he was... Why, is that a big deal?
Aiding and abetting.
Aiding and abetting? What is that, a major thing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
An accessory?
As you can see, this is an unusual interviewing room. This is because we were giving the impression, we hoped, of a very small town police station where they only had the sheriff's office and a storeroom and an outer office. So he's being interviewed in the storeroom with old TV sets and anything else that... bits of evidence, anything else they're keeping.
Your friend has put you in a lot of trouble.
What's going to happen to Bill?
Nothing. Unless he's convicted. Of course, if he is, we're going to run enough electricity through him to light up Birmingham.
A lot of people... We were friends at NYU, and we both applied... fear that getting arrested in a small hick town would be a terrible thing to happen to them. And I think one of the reasons this film didn't play as well in the South as it did everywhere else in the country is because Southerners thought it would be another stereotypical view of them. In fact, they're all treated very sensitively, I think, in this film, very kindly. There is no villain in this film. Unusually, there is no villain. The sheriff, the prosecutor, Jim Trotter III, and the judge are all acting completely reasonably and completely rightly within the system, and it's a simple case of mistaken identity. At the end of the movie, the sheriff does the right thing and actually helps exonerate the two boys, and it's unusual to find a movie which has a lot of tension and yet no bad guy. The bad guy is the system.
You know what this is all about?
Yeah, they're fucking with us.
And you don't believe them?
No, they don't execute for shoplifting.
You think we're being booked for shoplifting, huh?
No, you're being booked for shoplifting. I'm being booked for accessory to shoplifting.
No, Stan, I'm being booked for murder. And you're being booked for accessory to murder.
It's time to make your phone calls.
This is another handheld scene. Handheld camera. Done this way for the same reason. And here you see the two kids, well, especially Stan, played by Mitchell Whitfield, assuming that they've been arrested by a bunch of moronic hicks. And you can see the North's prejudice against the South in this scene.
Ma, Ma, please. Ma, please. First of all, we didn't do it, all right? Murder. Ma, Ma, please. Ma, Ma, it's a mistake, all right? We must look like the guys who did it. I don't know what it is.
Tell her what we think is happening. We think it's happening.
Shut up. We think they're trying to set us up as patsies, Ma. You know how corrupt it is down here? They all know each other.
It's like the clans here. They're inbred. They sleep with their sisters. Some of them do.
All right, Ma, listen. We got to get an attorney, and it's going to cost a lot of money. How much would an attorney cost?
A decent one? $50,000, $100,000?
$50,000, $100,000. I know, Ma. I know. Can we use any attorney?
I think so.
He says he thinks so. Oh, he is? Well, that's a great idea. That's a great idea. You think he'll do it?
What?
We got an attorney in the family.
Great. Who?
My cousin Vinny.
So this is what's known in the business as a star entrance. The film hasn't been going for all that long. We talk about Vinny. We hear about him. We know he's a lawyer. We hear his name. And then we have this elaborate montage in which he drives into town in this beat-up old car, making much too much noise with a lot of music that definitely doesn't come from around these parts. And various types in the town watch him with dismay or horror or curiosity as he cruises around the main square. And it's not till the end of this scene that we finally meet him. This is actually the main square of a town called Montecito in Georgia, which is one of three towns that we used to create the town in the movie, all within about an hour's drive of each other. And, you know, Vinny actually appears on a cord from the music with the courthouse behind him. And the car, which is, of course, crucial to his character and Lisa's character in the foreground. They're both garage mechanics, and in the end, that becomes central to the plot. Actually, she's not a garage mechanic. She's the daughter of a garage mechanic, and she knows all about cars.
Nothing. You stick out like a sore thumb around here.
Me? What about you?
I fit in better than you. At least I'm wearing cowboy boots.
Oh, yeah, you blend.
This was the first scene we shot with Marissa Tomei. And when we looked at her line, "Yeah, you blend," in dailies the next day, I knew that we had cast the right person for the role. In that moment, I knew. We'd taken quite a risk. She was not well known in films. I think she'd only played one other part in movies, in a film called Oscar, a small part. I'd seen her on the set there working with John Landis, and gone with John Landis to the cutting room to look at her performance, which was playing a 1920s flapper, blonde flapper, very different, but I could see how funny and talented she was. And we got her into read. She read wonderfully, and we persuaded the studio to let me go with this unknown film actress in the role. It was the best decision that I ever made. And in the end, she won the Oscar. This is a prison in Gainesville, Georgia. It's the state prison. It's real. We shot there for several days. It does have a death row right beside the wing where we were shooting, and I looked all around death row. It's a really frightening building, and we were all pretty scared when we were there. Even though we had guards with us at all times, there were tremendous security issues getting in and out during the shoot. It took approximately half an hour to 40 minutes to get from outside the prison to any location inside. This wing where we shot was the wing where they keep prisoners who have been put into solitary confinement for their own protection. We didn't use any of the prisoners as extras except in the background, you know, as you just saw them very briefly, and in a basketball scene that comes later. But all the prison guards are prison guards, the actual prison guards.
Do whatever he wants.
There's only the two of us here. What about those cots?
I mean, what if they put somebody else in here?
Stan. Shut up.
Okay.
Scene that comes next where Stan meets Vinny and they have a big misunderstanding about the purpose of this visit was in the script originally and then had been dropped from the version that I read that Fox sent me. We all agreed that this is a scene that absolutely had to go back, and with audiences this got some of the biggest laughs in the movie.
I don't want to do this.
Hey, I don't blame you. If I was in your situation, I'd want to get through this whole thing as quickly and with as little pain as possible. So, you know, let's try our best to make it a simple in-and-out procedure. What's the matter? Relax. You know, maybe we should spend a couple of minutes together, you know, to get acquainted before we, before we get to it. What's wrong with you?
Rehearsal is something that I normally like. This film wasn't rehearsed at all. Joe believed that he could do his best work with spontaneity and just by rehearsing on the day. And one of the jobs of the director is to make it as easy as possible for the actors, for the leading actors particularly. You're not there to make their life more difficult. You're there to do whatever it is that helps produce the best performance. So, with Joe feeling that he didn't like to rehearse, we didn't rehearse. I was nervous about that, but he was always remarkable on the day. And, we did get a tremendous amount of spontaneity that it's possible that rehearsal would have killed.
I did not come down here just to get jerked off, you know.
No, no. I'm not jerking you off. I'm not doing anything.
Lack of rehearsal, of course, doesn't mean that the actors are not prepared. It just means they're prepared privately. One of the interesting things about the scene we just saw when Vinny comes to visit the guys in a cell is that in reality it couldn't take place. And we discussed that at length. The whole scene would have taken place where this scene takes place, in an interview room. However, it would have meant losing that extremely funny scene, and we decided to bet that nobody noticed that it should have taken place in an interview room, and in fact, nobody ever did.
Well, up till now, personal injury.
Well, you're a trial attorney, right? I mean, personal injury trials.
Well, actually, this would be my first foray into the trial process. I haven't had to go to court yet. Knock on wood.
You haven't had to go to court yet. How long have you been practicing?
Almost 6 weeks.
But, man, you graduated from law school 6 years ago. What have you been doing since?
Studying for the bar. 6 years?
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of studying.
Well, you know, to be honest with you, I didn't pass my first time out.
That's okay. You probably passed the second time, right?
I'm afraid not.
Three times a charm?
Not for me, it isn't. Nope. For me, six times was a charm.
Six times.
The script was substantially longer than the film, as is often the case. And one of the things that I did in prep was to edit and tighten it. And the original version of the script never showed or never revealed who had actually committed the murders. It seems to me that any courtroom drama, which is what this is, even though it's a comedy, you have to have conclusive proof that somebody else did it so that you know your guys are innocent. And it's sort of unsatisfying if you never know who committed the murder. So that was changed. And there were a lot of, you know, changes made in what's called a production rewrite leading up to the shoot. But, of course, the essential part of the film, the main body of the story and the creation of these wonderful characters was done by the writer Dale Lorna, who did a very fine job. I actually wrote the production rewrite myself, which is very common, because the director is on the spot. Dale was elsewhere directing a film himself, and you have to make a lot of adjustments for the actors and for the circumstances. Unlike a play, which may be acted by several or hundreds of actors during his lifetime, a film is usually only produced once, and the parts are usually only played once. So you don't force the actors to play something that doesn't suit them. You tailor the material to suit the only actors who are ever going to play those roles.
What we do have is every bit as sophisticated a system of justice as they do in the rest of the country.
Oh, sure.
You being from New York and all might have the impression that law is practiced with a certain degree of informality down here. It isn't.
Right.
I tell you this because I want you to know that when it comes to procedure, I'm not a patient man. I advise you, sir, when you come into my courtroom, you ought to know the letter of the law. I'll react harshly when you don't.
You should.
Don't think being from New York, you're going to get special treatment.
I shouldn't.
You won't. You'll be given no leeway whatsoever. I expect you know this information when you come into my courtroom.
Right.
You willing to accept those terms?
Right. No problem. Just this?
We had an extraordinarily short time to get this rather complicated crane shot. The sunset happened very fast that night. And we got three takes in, of which this was the best, and after that we lost that lovely pink sky. However, we did get a take that we liked.
Great. Vinny's first case. So, what can I do to help?
The choice of song here, Tammy Wynette singing Stand By Your Man, is of course exactly what the theme of the scene is. That is a real lumber mill. I sort of subliminally set that up by showing trucks with logs, huge logs going by frequently during the movie so that people knew that it was a timber district. That was the local industry.
What's the story with this incredibly, remarkably loud whistle at 5:30 in the morning?
It's a steam whistle. Huh? Over at the sawmill. Tell folks it's time to get up. You can hear it for miles. Y'all want something?
Yes. think? Good choice. Two.
What you see here is scarcely an exaggeration. In the parts of rural Georgia where we were shooting, everything was cooked in lots of lard.
You guys down here hear about the ongoing cholesterol problem in the country?
And most of us on the film crew felt very keenly about this scene. Yeah, the food was very fatty.
You never heard of grits?
Sure, I heard of grits. I just actually never seen a grit before. Yeah, honey, you can try it.
And this scene, which of course appears to be just jokes about southern food, becomes critical later. It's one of the...
made out of corn.
One of the ways in which he discredits the first witness. With his knowledge of the cooking of grits.
How do you cook it?
Well, you sim it in water for 15 or 20 minutes. Put it on the plate and add butter.
Huh.
Well, you gonna eat it or not?
This courtroom is pretty much an accurate reproduction of the courtroom in Montecito in Georgia, where in part of my prep for the movie I watched a murder trial for several days. Some of the lines that are used by the lawyers later in the scene, in the courtroom scenes, came directly out of that trial that I watched.
It's your turn in here.
I am the attorney.
Oh, Jim Trotter, the third. District Attorney, Beecham County.
Vincent LaGuardia Gambini, first, Brooklyn.
For me, it's important that the prosecutor was called Jim Trotter, the third. I wanted to establish old money, old families, people who had been there for generations. Because for me, perhaps because I'm a British director, this film is about the class system, among other things. In Hollywood, it's customary to talk about this kind of genre as a fish-out-of-water comedy. Namely, Vinny is from Brooklyn and he comes to the South where he is a so-called fish out of water. For me, that's not what's significant about it. What's significant about it is that he's a blue-collar guy who used to be a garage mechanic and has been to a night school to learn to become a lawyer. And his girlfriend is a hairdresser. And these are working-class people up against the establishment. Jim Trotter III is a prosecutor, a judge who went to Yale, people who see society from a superior position. And I think that's an important element of the conflict in this film.
He told me to sit here.
When you're addressed in this court, you will rise and speak to me in a clear, intelligible voice.
Sorry. My clients are...
What are you wearing?
Huh?
What are you wearing?
I'm wearing clothes. I don't get the question.
When you come into my court looking like you do, you not only insult me, but you insult the integrity of this court.
This scene is an example of what I mean by the class situation. Vinny doesn't understand why dressing in a black leather jacket and no tie is an insult to the integrity of the court. But to a man like the judge, it's obvious that it's an insult to the integrity of the court and that you should be dressed in a way that he considers appropriate. So this is a culture clash and a class clash that's taking place here with two people who simply don't understand each other's view of life and of behavior.
No, I'm just trying to explain.
I don't want to hear explanations. The state of Alabama has its procedure. And that procedure at this point in time is to have an arraignment. Are we clear on this?
Yes. But there seems to be a great deal of confusion here.
Mr. Gambini.
See, my client's
Mr. Gambini.
This camera angle, of course, looking down on Joe Pesci, intensifies the fact that he looks like a little kid up in front of the teacher.
It was a very simple answer to a very simple question. There are only two ways to answer it, guilty or not guilty.
Your Honor, my clients didn't do anything.
Once again, the communication process is broken down. It appears to me...
One of the things that I was very concerned about and which was... which we worked on in the production rewrite, was the accuracy of the court proceedings. I actually have a degree in law myself. I went to law school, and I get terribly irritated when I see films in which the legal procedure is obviously wrong. I'm very pleased with the fact that although this is heightened for comedic purposes, that everything that you see legally in this film could happen and is approximately correct. Which, by the way, makes it the more frightening.
Now, how do your clients plead?
I think I get the point.
No, I don't think you do. You're now in contempt of court. Would you like to go for 2 counts of contempt?
Not guilty.
Thank you. Bail will be set at $200,000. Preliminary hearing will be set for 9:30 a.m. tomorrow morning. Bailiff, please take Mr. Gambini into custody. His bail will be set at $200.
Come with me, please.
Fred Gwynne was approximately a foot taller than Joe Pesci, maybe more. And this was not the reason I cast him, but it certainly didn't hurt us.
Let's go.
This whole issue of the murder case and the fact that Norton is about to be electrocuted was another element that's important to me, although we didn't hammer it hard on the head. I'm actually an opponent of capital punishment myself. I think one of the things that's wrong with the death penalty is that mistakes are made all too often by courts, by judges, by juries. I think a significant number of people are wrongly convicted of murder. You know, the statistics have made that very clear. And so I'm an opponent of the death penalty, and for me this film shows just how easy it would be for Bill and Stan to be sent to the electric chair by a well-meaning court run by honest people if they hadn't had the luck of having this incredibly argumentative guy who was smart enough to see the flaws in the prosecution case. Most defendants on capital charges don't have that kind of luck.
I don't know how you can be so sure when you don't know what it is you're supposed to know.
It's a procedure. Like rebuilding a carburetor has a procedure. You know when you rebuild a carburetor, the first thing you do is you take the carburetor off the manifold? Supposing you skip the first step. And while you're replacing one of the jets, you accidentally drop the jet, it goes down the carburetor, rolls along the manifold, and goes into the head. You're fucked. You just learned the hard way that you gotta remove the carburetor first, right? So that's all that happened to me today. I learned the hard way. Actually, it was a good learning experience for me.
All right, well, is there any way I could help out in this procedure situation?
Yeah. Keep bailing me out.
All right, there is one problem. We can't afford to keep bailing you out. I already cashed in half the traveler's checks. I didn't want to cash them in, but I didn't want to bounce the check, so I tried hustling the money, but I got stiffed, so I had to cash in the travel.
Oh, what do you mean you got stiffed? Did you say you got stiffed?
When I was scouting around for locations, I saw a restaurant with pool and chicken, a sign like that outside, and I thought that would be a very good setting for this. We had to find location here, which was hard, the pool hall, opposite the hotel, and beside the railroad track, for reasons that will come up later in the movie. We converted that giant warehouse across the street into a hotel. It's not really a hotel. The joke with the chicken leg happened just because that guy was fooling around and showed us he could do it, so we thought we'd better put it in the film.
His name's JT.
JT. I believe you and Lisa played a game of pool for $200, which she won. I'm here to collect.
How about if I just kick your ass?
Oh, a counteroffer. That's what we lawyers, I'm a lawyer, we lawyers call that a counteroffer. Let me see.
This is one of Dale's most beautifully written scenes. I love the fact that he turns this argument into a sort of legal negotiation. And of course, a lot of the laughs come from the reaction shots of these guys who are extras.
Over my dead body.
You like to renegotiate.
And in fact, those shots were shot much later.
Do I have to kill you? What if I was just to kick the ever-loving shit out of you?
In your dreams.
Oh, no. In reality.
The extras were all local people who wanted to be in the movie. I don't think they were professional extras. They're just people whose faces I liked that we recruited.
What happened? Rear-ended?
No, I fell.
Oh. Okay, let's see if we agree on the terms. The choice now is I get my ass kicked, or...
I don't think we caused a lot of disruption in the towns where we shot. Nobody had to be relocated. People were pretty pleased, I think, that we came in and offered a little bit of extra work. It's not the richest part of the country. We were lucky. We all stayed in a Jack Nicklaus-designed resort golf course half an hour away, so we were living in great luxury. It was the winter, so nobody else was using it.
Did you fall in your place or somebody else's?
My place.
Shit. He blew the arraignment!
This scene is in the real prison. There's a old prisoners playing in the background. This is the way it actually is. This is the way basketball is played and exercises is obtained in a maximum security prison. Razor wire runs along the top of each of these tiny little cages.
Did you die for that? Wouldn't your mother be more upset if you die?
The thing is, given the chance, I think you could do a good job.
No, you're wrong.
Come on, fellas, knock it off. Let's go.
Sam, listen to me. You have to see the Gambinis in action. I
mean, yes, the prisoners were all extremely cooperative and did exactly what we asked. I don't know what incentives or threats were made in order to achieve that. This is another very fine piece of Dale's writing, this scene in which a discussion about the dripping tap becomes a love scene between these two people who love mechanical objects. It's a uniquely written love scene.
Why'd you turn it off?
I did turn it off.
Well, if you turned it off, why am I listening to it?
Did it ever occur to you it could be turned off and ripped at the same time?
And in this scene, you also see how these two people love argument. They thrive on argument. Argument is the basis of their relationship, the basis of their characters. And it's why Vinny, although he's so argumentative, is such a lovable character. Joe Pesci pulled off a great trick in this film, which is to play someone who is obnoxious, argumentative, and difficult in every respect, and yet you really like.
...particular model faucet requires a range of 10 to 16 foot-pounds of torque. I routinely twist maximum allowable torqueage.
Well, how could you be sure you used 16 foot-pounds of torque?
Because I used a Craftsman Model 1019 Laboratory Edition Signature Series torque wrench, the kind used by Caltech high-energy physicists and NASA engineers.
Well, in that case, how could you be sure that's accurate?
Because a split second before the torque wrench was applied to the faucet handle, it had been calibrated by top members of the state and federal department of weights and measures to be dead on balls accurate. Here's a certificate of validation.
Dead on balls accurate?
It's an industry term.
I guess the fucking thing is broken.
Extra energy is given to the scene where Joe Pesci sits up by, as he sits up towards the camera zooms and tracks in on him. More than half the action of the movie, I think, takes place in the courtroom. This is a big challenge for a director because you have to keep it visually interesting, all in one room. You have to keep finding new angles, new shots, new ways of moving the camera, which do not distract the viewer and do not distract from the action that's taking place. So the problem is to do it without finding absurd angles or ridiculous wide-angle lenses, but to always try and find a slightly new position for the camera.
Yes, it is.
Thank you, ma'am.
In this scene, I kept the camera moving, very much in terms of the mood of what was going on, moving around the prosecutor, moving in on the witnesses, moving out from the witnesses, moving with the boys as they react.
Looked out the window. They was running out, got into the car, drove off.
Is this the car?
Yes, it is.
Thank you, sir. Then you saw those two boys run out of the sack of suds, jump in this car, and take off?
Yeah, they peeled away. Car was all over the road.
Thank you, sir.
I asked him if he did it, and he said, I shot the clerk. I asked him again. And again he said, I shot the clerk.
Your Honor, no further questions.
Mr. Gambini?
Yes.
And finally, the camera stops moving after it cranes up from the sheriff to the judge. And at that point, the camera starts moving because we now move into a comedy scene. I no longer am interested in creating tension and jeopardy, which the camera movement and the music was doing. I'm now interested in focusing on the laughs.
Now, didn't I tell you next time you appear in my courtroom that you dress appropriately?
You were serious about that? Why didn't you ask him any questions?
Questions?
Excellent questions.
He knew you could ask questions. Didn't you, then?
Maybe if you put up some kind of a fight, you could have gotten the case thrown out.
Hey, Stan. You're an Alabama. You come from New York. You killed a good old boy. There is no way. This is not going to trial.
What the fuck is going on here, Vinny?
This shot and the other shot outside the prison when they walk and talk are the only two occasions in the film when we use a Steadicam, which is a kind of floating handheld camera, different from a regular camera, which is actually handheld. I prefer to use a track than a Steadicam because when you put the camera on a track, The director knows exactly what the camera's going to see at every point in the shot. With a Steadicam, you're very much dependent on what the Steadicam operator shoots, which is going to be different every single time. Also, Steadicams have a tendency to sort of float when standing still, which I think can be a little distracting. So I only use a Steadicam when I can't use a track for practical reasons. All of the hotels we used were buildings that we had to recondition. This particular hotel opposite the pig farm was once a hotel but was virtually falling down. And we shored up the floor of this room, this upstairs room, but there were no other rooms in the hotel upstairs that was safe to walk in because you would probably fall through the floor. We had a lot of safety concerns that day for the crew.
I don't know. I don't feel good.
Hey, you shouldn't feel good. You haven't slept much in 3 days.
That's part of it. You know what it is? I'm really scared.
You should be.
How the fuck did I get into this shit? Oh, sure. No problem. I could win the case. I already got myself sent to jail twice. I could win this thing, though. I know I could. I mean, if I could keep my ass awake and out of jail long enough, I bet you I could, huh?
You know what I think?
What?
Honestly? I think that once you're out there and you're doing your thing out there, I think you're going to be really great.
But this hotel needed to be opposite a farm, just as the other hotels needed to be opposite a pool room and a railroad track and so forth. So you convert buildings that are there to your own purposes. Said anything about Randy Edelman's wonderful score so far.
You think that's what's happening?
This particular cue is one of my favorites, but all the music that he wrote for the film seems to me to be perfect. It's got a wonderful, jazzy, bluesy, very leisurely southern feel about it, and yet it creates energy whenever we need it. Very atmospheric. That actually isn't Death Row in there, but it used to be. The story about the guy being fried and having 3 attempts before his head caught fire was something that I heard on the radio while I was down in Georgia. So I put that scene in to intensify the jeopardy that the boys are in. And also because it's very funny in an appallingly sick way. Horrible though it is, it always got quite a laugh from the audience. That's because of the callousness of the guard who's discussing saving electricity bills by making the electric chair work better. Discussing this with two people who are about to be fried.
Why don't you just tell me your side of the story?
Okay.
All right. Hang it in.
Where's Stan?
Oh, Stan, he's not coming. Stan. He's, well, he wants to go with the public defender.
This scene is the scene in which Vinny convinces Bill that he should continue to represent him. And in the course of the dialogue, Vinny does a card trick It was really important to me that the card trick wasn't faked. Of course, you can fake anything by cutting and showing another shot. But I talked about this to Joe before we started shooting, and he learned how to do this card trick. So the scene in which he does it does not have any cuts in it. He actually fools the audience before their very eyes. He did it beautifully. I felt that Vinny's argument would be much less powerful if the audience could say, oh, well, that was just faked by, you know, the way the scene was cut.
He's going to show you the bricks. He'll show you they got straight sides. He'll show you how they got the right shape. He showed them to you in a very special way, so that they appear to have everything a brick should have. But there's one thing he's not going to show you. When you look at the bricks at the right angle, they're as thin as this playing card. His whole case is an illusion, a magic trick. It has to be an illusion, because you're innocent. Nobody, I mean nobody, pulls the wool over the eyes of a Gambini, especially this one. Give me the chance. One chance. Let me question the first witness. If after that point you don't think that I'm the best man for the job, fire me then and there. I'll leave quietly. No grudges. All I ask is for that one chance. I think you should give it to me.
He thinks you should give it to him? What was he before he was a lawyer? A fucking comedian?
How can it hurt? If he doesn't ask the right questions, your lawyer will, right?
No, he can still fuck things up. There's more to cross-examination than knowing what to say. It's knowing what not to say. Look, let's say he asks all the possible questions, right? And the witness has all the answers. He ends up proving the prosecution's case. How did he ever talk you into it?
At my cousin Ruthie's wedding, the groom's brother was that guy Alakazam. You know who I'm talking about?
The magician with the ponytail?
Right. Well, he did his act. And every time he made something disappear, Vinny jumped on him. I mean, he nailed him. He was like, it's in his pocket. Or he's palming it, you know. Or there's a mirror under the table. I mean, he was like, wait a second. It's joined in the middle and there's a spring around it. It pops it open when it's inside the tube. I mean, it's like Alakazam's worst nightmare. But he was just being Vinny. He was just being the quintessential Gambini.
And that scene also is there to reinforce the jeopardy. You've got to have serious jeopardy for a really funny comedy.
Hey, little Yankee boy, look here what I got.
What is it?
$200.
Bring it here, let me see it. How do I know that's not a bunch of ones with a 20 wrapped around it?
It's $200.
Fan it out. Show it to me. Yeah, right.
We had an interesting problem mixing the sound for this scene. Nowadays, with digital sound, we could have made this louder, more penetrating. A few years ago, though, before digital sound, you couldn't go that loud with a soundtrack. And so you had to create an illusion of an intense sound that would wake up everybody. Without actually being able to do it. Maybe that was better than blowing people out of their seats.
Freight train comes through at 5 a.m. every morning.
No, sir. It's very unusual.
Okay.
I was making a lot of money, winning most of my cases.
Excuse me, Mr.
Oh, thank you, Shirley. But my clients were guilty as hell.
And here we see Jim Trotter explaining why he's a prosecutor. And you can see he's not a bad guy. He's not a vindictive guy. He just thinks he's doing something necessary and important.
Well, that's what I've been doing, and I'm a happier man for it. How about you?
Well, I got a bullshit traffic ticket. I went to court. I got the cop on the stand, and I argued with him until he admitted he was wrong. And the judge, this Judge Malloy, all the while he's laughing and smiling. And then afterwards, he asked me to go to lunch with him. And then he says to me, you know what? You'd be a good litigator. I don't know what the hell he was talking about. I don't know what a litigator
was. Although the courtroom was built in Covington in Georgia, all of these offices, the judges' chambers, the prosecutor's office and everything, were all in the real courthouse in Montecito.
He would come by, see how I was doing, if I needed anything.
Very cramped locations, but just occasionally you could see something moving outside the window or...
He wanted his son to follow in his footsteps, but he became a musician or something. I remember when I graduated, he was so proud of me.
That's quite a story.
Yeah.
It had an authenticity that seemed to help me and the actors.
I'd like to have a murder weapon. But other than that, I feel pretty good.
You do?
Oh, yeah. Hey, what are you doing this afternoon?
You going hunting?
That's right.
Why are you going hunting? Shouldn't you be out preparing for court?
I was thinking last...
There are several high points in Marissa Tomei's performance. One is the moment on the witness stand. One is the moment when she talks about her biological clock. A moment that most people who have seen the film seem to remember. And one is this speech she gives about the deer being shot.
He's not going to let me look at his files, but, you know, maybe he'll relax enough to drop his guard so that I can finesse.
Superbly played.
What am I going to wear?
Marissa and Joe had extraordinary chemistry together. This is something directors can never predict. When you cast people who have never worked together and don't know each other, which is what mostly happens, you hope they're going to work well together and there's going to be some kind of rapport. Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't, but sometimes it's a kind of a perfect fit. And in this case, Vinny and Lisa, two wonderful characters written by Dale who you really haven't seen on the screen before, the way they were written, are played by people who work together perfectly.
Oh!
Imagine you're a deer. You're prancing along, you get thirsty, you spot a little brook, you put your little deer lips down to the cool, clear water. Bam! A fucking bullet rips off part of your head. Your brains are laying on the ground in little bloody pieces. Now I ask you, would you give a fuck what kind of pants the son of a bitch who shot you was wearing?
Sure like to get a look at your files.
You would?
Sure.
You got a Xerox machine over there?
No.
Oh, that's okay. I'll have my secretary do it. Shirley, can you Xerox all the files on the Gambini-Rothenstein case for Mr. Gambini? Yeah. Thanks, sweetheart.
What's all that?
Father's files. All of them.
You stole his files?
I didn't steal his files. Listen to this. I'm just ready to finesse him. I'm starting to finesse him.
We were shooting in winter and the days were short. So technically what you have to do is shoot all the shots that face out towards the window. It's a real window. This is a real room. So you shoot towards the window when there's daylight, and then as the light starts to fail, and as you go on into the evening, you do the shots that shoot away from the window, and the cameraman has to match the sunlight with artificial light. People think that a good cameraman is someone who shoots beautiful exteriors. But in fact, nature has done the lighting there. The mark of a really good cameraman is someone who can match the lighting in difficult circumstances.
Didn't teach you that in law school either?
So there's the sack of suds across the street, and this is a house right opposite, and then here's the next house with the next witness.
What'd you have for breakfast?
That montage, if you can call it a montage, those three little scenes with the witnesses were originally much longer, but we found that we could get the essential information in very quickly, and there weren't really any jokes in there, so we compressed them. That business of ringing the bell, which Joe came up with spontaneously, was extremely funny. And we made it even longer by the way we cut it. So as we cut between the two shots, we got even more bell ringing.
Can you participate in an endeavor in which the ultimate decision might be death by electrocution? Ma'am?
I think it should be left up to the victims' families rather than the courts.
Uh-huh. The defendants...
I liked the idea of a very respectable, middle-class, grey-haired lady saying Friam rather than somebody who looked like a redneck.
You think you could...
Friam.
She'll do.
Fred Gwynne, who plays the judge, was terribly famous to Americans, principally as Herman Munster. I didn't know that. I just knew him as the very tall guy in the Cotton Club. There was some prejudice from some people against casting him because they said he's Herman Munster, you can't have Herman Munster as the judge. Happily, because I'm from England and a foreigner, not brought up watching American television, it didn't bother me. And in fact, Fred was as perfect for the role of the judge as anybody could be.
You're not going to find any records of Vincent LaGuardia Gambini practicing in any courts.
I just told you that.
You don't understand. See, 20 years ago, I became an actor. And there was this very prominent stage actor in New York. His name was Vincent Gambini. Maybe you heard of him.
No.
Ever heard of it? Doesn't matter. Anyway, I had to change my name, which I did legally. So now I practice law under my legally changed stage name.
What name is that?
Terry Gallo. Terry Gallo. You can still call me Gambini. Sorry.
And what name did you tell him?
Jerry Gallo.
Jerry Gallo? The big attorney?
Yeah.
Think that was a smart move?
Yeah, well, the man is a seriously accomplished lawyer. He checks up on this guy, his name will show up all over the place.
His name was in the papers all last week.
Yeah, I saw that.
But you didn't actually read the article.
No.
So bad.
Why is that?
Because he's dead.
This costume that Marissa wore in this scene seems to me to be an inspiration by the costume designer.
Well, yeah, I am.
What are you nervous about? I'm the one that's under the gun here. Anybody else starts tomorrow.
You want to know what I'm nervous about? I'll tell you what I'm nervous about. I am in the dark here with all this legal crap. I have no idea what's going on. All I know is you're screwing up, and I can't help.
You lent me a little camera, didn't you?
Oh, Vinny, I'm watching you go down in flames, and you're bringing me with you, and I can't do anything about it.
And?
Well, I hate to bring it up because I know you got enough pressure on you already. But we agreed to get married as soon as you won your first case. Meanwhile,
In this scene, you see these two actors at the top of their form. Her big scene, her big speech about the biological clock. And now his reply. Both perfectly played.
Lisa, I don't need this. I swear to God, I do not need this right now, okay? I got a judge that's just aching to throw me in jail. An idiot who wants to fight me for $200. Slaughtered pigs. Giant loud whistles. I ain't slept in 5 days. I got no money. A dress code problem. And a little murder case which, in the balance, holds the lives of 2 innocent kids. Not to mention your biological clock. My career. Your life, our marriage, and let me see, what else can we pile on? Is there any more shit we could pile on to the top of the outcome of this case? Is it possible?
Maybe it was a bad time to bring it up.
This scene, the last time that Vinny is woken unexpectedly, is the scene with the screech owl.
What the fuck is that?
We used a real screech owl in this scene, which was probably a ridiculous chance to take. People look at the scene and they think it's a Muppet because its behavior was so perfect. It screeched, it looked back at Vinny, then it looked back at the camera and screeched again. We got amazingly lucky with that screech owl, which, by the way, is a very small animal. It's about 8 inches high. The screeches, of course, were artificially induced. We discovered that if you put a little bit of meat into its beak, it half swallows them, and then approximately 3 seconds later opens its beak as the food, as the meat goes down. So we fed it a little bit of beef just before the camera started turning, so that for its first screech, which is added afterwards, his beak opened at the right moment. Everything else he did in that scene was pure luck. And we couldn't believe our eyes when he reacted so perfectly, and of course we never shot it again. He had been trained just a little bit. An owl is a wild creature. You can't train him. But he had heard a lot of gunfire in the previous weeks so that he wouldn't get frightened by it. But he was an extremely ambivalent small creature, and on the one hand he wanted to fly away, on the other hand he wanted the meat that we had. So he hung around. I love that fall when the feet go straight up in the air. This film doesn't have a lot of physical comedy, but what it does have, I think, is in the right place, and certainly that brought the house down when we first showed it to audiences.
What was in that pink plastic thing in the trunk?
It's your suit.
What is my suit doing in the trunk?
I had it clean. I thought it'd be a nice surprise. Go in there with a nice clean suit.
You got 30 fucking minutes to take a shower, get a new suit, get dressed, and get to the fucking courthouse.
You fucking shower, I'll get your fucking suit.
Hey, little Yankee, what?
Yeah. I got you $200.
You gonna kick the shit out of me now?
My first thought for that little fight was a little more conventional. Joe felt strongly, and he was right, that he should just walk across the road and leap at the guy and knock him out. He was right, of course, it's much more surprising. So here, in tune with the opening scene of the trial itself, Vinny's late, and I held all these shots as long as I dared. People waiting, tapping their fingers, wondering where he is. It's all part of the setup for the costume he enters in. Mitchell Woodfield's double take there. Vinny in his tuxedo got an enormous laugh, but one of the reasons, I think, is the very long pause before he enters while everyone waits.
Mr. Gambini, are you mocking me with that outfit?
Mocking you? No, I'm not mocking you, Judge.
Then explain that outfit.
I bought a suit. You've seen it. Now it's covered in mud. This town doesn't have a one-hour cleaner, so I had to buy a new suit. Except that the only store you could buy a new suit in has got the flu. You get that? The whole store got the flu. So I had to get this in a second-hand store. So it's either wear the leather jacket, which I know you hate, or this. So I wore this ridiculous thing for you.
You on drugs?
Drugs? No. I don't take drugs.
I don't like your attitude.
What else is new?
Now, I'm holding you in contempt of court.
Oh, there's a fucking surprise.
What'd you say?
What?
What'd you just say?
What'd I say? What?
Your Honor, counsel, members of the jury, the evidence in this case is going to show...
Everything in the speech, we know now. We already know. So there was no point in shooting this scene in a close-up. On the other hand, it was necessary to recap the prosecution's case, the essential points of it. So I used this opportunity to have a high, wide crane shot, which gradually moves in on the prosecutor and the jury, and then pans around to Vinny and the defendants. It's an atmospheric shot with some atmospheric music. And it was possible because this was a recapitulation of everything that we knew already. And it brings us slowly and into the process of the trial.
To the sheriff of Beecham County. Now let's get down, Willie Clark.
Outside, you can hear the thunder. At the start of the scene, you saw rain. Because at this point, you know, Vinny and his defendants are a low ebb.
That's what verdict means. It's a word comes down from old England and all our little old ancestors.
The line about the word coming down from England and the little old ancestors and cutting to a black juror responding to that notion came from an actual trial that I watched in Georgia. Those very words.
Gambini, commit this hyenas crime.
As did the pronunciation of the word hyenas for heinous or heinous. But that unique pronunciation I picked up from a real prosecutor in Georgia, suggested it to Lane. Wrote it into the script.
Counselor.
Lane Smith is a wonderful actor. He'd been great as Richard Nixon in a TV film a couple of years earlier. And I liked him so much that I gave him a leading role in my next film, The Distinguished Gentleman, with Eddie Murphy.
Everything that guy just says is bullshit. Thank you.
Objection, Your Honor. Counsel's entire opening statement is argument.
Objection sustained. The entire opening statement, with the exception of thank you, will be stricken from the record. The jury will please disregard counsel's entire opening statement. And you, Mr. Gambini, you will not use that kind of language in my court. You understand me?
Yeah. Putz.
Counselor?
Your statement, sir.
Austin Pendleton, who plays the public defender and gives a superb performance, was a very old friend of mine. He was the original Mottle the Tailor in the musical Fiddler on the Roof with Zero Mostel in 1964. A couple of years later, I played the role of Mottle the Tailor in the original London cast with Topol, and Austin and I met at that time. We were friends for 23 years before we finally got a chance to work together in this film. When I sent him the script, Austin thought it was a sick joke. This is because he actually has a stutter in real life, although he hardly ever uses it in a performance. And this man is the ultimate stutterer. I knew that with Austin this would be hysterically funny, and in fact, in this opening speech to the jury, I had to hide behind the camera. I had to duck down behind the camera because I was laughing so much. Tears were rolling down my cheeks. I was terrified of making a sound and ruining the take.
The prosecution's case is...
This is one of the funniest moments I've ever witnessed, actually, live on a set. And in the background, you can see Mitchell Whitfield with his hand over his mouth, which looks like terror, but in fact, he's trying to hide the fact that he's laughing.
That's it. Mm. What about everything we talked about?
Well, I get a little nervous.
A little nervous?
I'm getting better.
I heard a gunshot. So I looked out the window, and I seen them two boys run out, get into their car, and drive off like maniacs, the tires screeching, smoking, going up on the curb.
Is this the call?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir. No further questions, John.
Your witness...
All right. Mr. Tipton. Now, when you viewed my clients, how far away were you?
About 50 feet.
Oh, now, nah, do you think that that's close enough to make an accurate, identification?
Yes.
Mr. Tipton, I see you wear eyeglasses.
Sometimes.
Well, would you care to show those eyeglasses to the jury, please? Thank you. Thank you. Now, Mr. Tipton, were you wearing them that day?
No.
Well, as you see, you were 50 feet away. You made a positive eyewitness identification, and yet... You were not wearing your necessary prescription eyeglasses.
They're reading glasses.
We did very little ADR in this film, or looping, or post-syncing, as it's called. There was a wonderful sound mixer who I've used on every one of my films, except one, called Bobby Anderson. And when you've got Bobby on a film, you don't need to do any post-syncing. The sound is always excellent from the original performance on the set. And that's the best way. It's always hard to recreate the moment later.
He's a tough one.
Yes.
This exchange between Joe Pesci and the judge is just coming up on the subject of two Utes. Became perhaps the most quoted piece of dialogue from the film. In fact, it's a conversation that happened between Joe Pesci and me in the Mayflower Hotel in New York when we were prepping the script. Joe said something to me about these two Utes who were on trial, and I said, what? And he said, what? And I said, what's a Ute?
Is it possible the two Utes...
Two what? What was that word?
What word?
To what?
What?
Did you say Utes?
Yeah, two Utes.
What is a Ute?
Oh, excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
That dialogue, as played there, is exactly what I said to Joe and he said to me in our meeting. And I realized, as we were having that conversation, that this was something that ought to happen between Vinny and the judge, so I simply wrote it in the way it happened naturally.
Two different men drive up in a similar... Don't shake your head, I'm not done yet. Wait till you hear the whole thing, so you can understand this now. Two different men drive up in a similar-looking car, go in, shoot the clerk, rob him, and then leave?
No, they didn't have enough time.
Well, how much time was they in the store?
5 minutes.
5 minutes? Are you sure? Did you look at your watch?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. You testified earlier that the boys went into the store and you had just begun to make breakfast. You were just ready to eat and you heard a gunshot. That's right. I'm sorry. So obviously it takes you 5 minutes to make breakfast.
That's right.
Right, so you knew that. Do you remember what you had?
It was remarkable how Joe Pesci kept up the energy in here for 4 weeks of continuous shooting. By now, it was early summer. It was very hot, very humid. We weren't in a studio. We were in a warehouse with a corrugated iron roof. And the temperatures were, I don't know, 120, 130 degrees. Everybody was holding fans. Sweat was pouring off everybody. And Joe Pesci kept up this phenomenal level of energy whenever the camera turned.
I don't know. I'm a fast cook, I guess.
I'm sorry, I was all the way over here. I couldn't hear you. Did you say you're a fast cook? That's it? Are we to believe that boiling water soaks into a grit faster in your kitchen than on any place on the face of the earth?
I don't know.
Well, perhaps the laws of physics cease to exist on your stove. Were these magic grits?
These scenes all took a long time to shoot because they're shot from a number of different angles. They're shot from the witness's point of view. They're shot from the judge's angle on Vinny. They're shot from the jury's point of view, the camera tracking backwards and forwards behind the jury. And all of this was necessary in order, when we cut the film, to make sure that the audience, although very familiar with the courtroom, was never seeing exactly the same setup. And that the camera was always in the right place.
You're fired. I want him!
Come on now, move it.
Don't worry. I'll find a way to bail you out.
No, don't. I'm going to stay in prison tonight. Maybe I'll finally get some sleep. Doing good, huh?
Joe had just won the Oscar for Goodfellas when we shot this scene. I think we shot this the next day. He flew in from Los Angeles. And on the first take, when we panned to him, he was clutching the Oscar in his arms. We sent that to the studio as the dailies.
My house and stuff.
House and stuff. And what is this brown stuff on the windows?
Dirt.
Dirt? What is this rusty, dusty, dirty-looking thing over your window?
It's a screen.
A screen. It's a screen. And what are these really big things right in the middle of your view from the window of your kitchen to the sack of suds? What do we call these big things?
Trees?
Trees, that's right. Don't be afraid. Just shout them right out when you know. Now, what are these thousands of little things that are on trees?
Leaves.
Leaves! And these bushy things between the trees.
Bushes.
Bushes. So, Mr. Crane, you could positively identify the defendants for a moment of 2 seconds. Looking through this dirty window, this crud-covered screen, these trees with all these leaves on them, and I don't know how many bushes.
It was like 5.
Uh-uh. Don't forget this one and this one.
7 bushes.
7 bushes. So, what do you think? Is it possible you just saw 2 guys in a green convertible? And not necessarily these 2 particular guys?
Well, I suppose.
I'm finished with this guy.
There we did a time lapse, right, showing the prosecutor and the sheriff reacting, apparently to the second witness, but as we pan and dolly over to Vinny, we see he's talking to the third witness. One of the problems with the courtroom scene is to get rid of all the routine stuff. I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, you know, bringing in the witness, sending out the witness, you may stand down, more swearing in. You've got to get rid of all that. As Alfred Hitchcock said, drama is life with the dull bits cut out.
As you've gotten older, how many different levels of thickness have you gone through?
Oh, I don't know. Over 60 years. Maybe 10 times.
Maybe you're ready for a thicker set.
Oh, no. I think they're okay.
Maybe we should make sure. Let's check it out. Now, how far were the defendants from you when you saw them entering the sack of suds?
About 100 feet.
100 feet. Would you hold this, please? Thank you. Sorry, excuse me. Sorry. Okay, this is 50 feet. That's half the distance. How many fingers am I holding up?
Let the record show that counsel is holding up 2 fingers.
Your Honor, please, huh?
Oh. Sorry.
Now, Mrs. Riley... And only Mrs. Riley. How many fingers am I holding?
That's a funny ad-lib from Joe on the set. And only Mrs. Riley. Enabling us to have another funny reaction from the judge.
What do you think now, dear?
Thinking of getting thicker glasses.
Thank you.
It was important that Joe discredited that little old black lady as a witness without being unpleasant to her.
Makes things kind of fun, doesn't it?
I'm enjoying myself so far.
Well, I got a little...
It's important that we like Vinny. And Joe played it in a way that was very warm and likable and still managed to destroy her evidence.
First thing in the morning, Judge's going to have to admit it.
Should I be worried?
I sure would be if I were you.
Honey, where did you read about all that disclosure shit?
Very often in the movie, there are shots at what we call a Dutched angle, a crooked angle, like the opening shot of this expert here. I had a lot of those shots in the prison. I used them to create a feeling of anxiety or unsettlement or something just not being quite right. The best example of Dutched angles that I know in any movie is the great film The Third Man, directed by Carol Reed, starring Joseph Cotten and Orson Welles. where those Dutch dangles are used superbly all the way through the film. It's set in Vienna in 1947. Black and white film. As well as to give the defense an opportunity to have the witnesses' reports reviewed by... And the use of the Dutch angles there does a tremendous amount to create unease and a sense of jeopardy.
That is a lucid, intelligent, well-thought-out objection.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Overruled.
Now, Mr. Weldon, these are photos of tires belonging to the defendant's car, and these are photos of the tire marks left by the assailant's car as it fled the convenience store. Now, are you familiar with these?
Yes, I am.
Uh-huh. Could you elaborate, please, sir?
We compared the tire marks outside the convenience store with the rear tires of the defendant's car. They're the same model and size tire. Michelin model XGV, size 75R, 14-inch wheel.
They're the same size and model tire. Anything else, sir?
Yes, indeed. The car, leaving the convenience store, spun its rear tires dramatically and left a residue of rubber on the asphalt. Now, I took a sample of that rubber and analyzed it. I also took a sample of the rubber from the rear tires of the defendant's Buick and analyzed that, too.
What kind of equipment did you use to find this out?
I used the Hewlett-Packard 57-10A dual-column gas chromatograph with flame analyzation detectors.
Uh-huh. Is that thing turbocharged?
Only on the floor models.
Now, Mr. Wilbur, what was the result of your analysis?
The chemical composition between the two samples was found to be identical.
Identical.
How Lane came up with identical, I'll never know, but it was a moment of sheer genius.
Court will take a 60-minute recess for lunch.
Your Honor, I respectfully request a full day's continuance to go over all this stuff.
Request denied.
Thanks a lot.
Hey, Mr. Gambini.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to speak to you in my chambers. You're a dead man.
I'm a dead man?
That's right. I just faxed the clerk of New York and asked him what he knew about Jerry Gallo. And you want to know what he replied?
Did you say Jerry Gallo?
Yes, I did.
Gallo with the G?
That's right.
Jerry Gallo's dead.
I'm aware of that.
Well, I'm not Jerry Gallo. I'm Jerry Callo. C-A-L-L-O.
All right. All right. Let's get this cleared up right now. Hello? This is Judge Chamberlain Haller. Can I speak to the clerk? Okay, I'll be here. You can call back after 3. That gives you a stay of execution. Unless by some miracle you happen to win this case in the next 90 minutes. Why don't you go to lunch?
That's what's known in the script writing and film development business as a ticking clock. Literally in this case. We know that he has to win the case within 90 minutes or he's discovered as a fraud. It's another way of adding tension. Suspense.
I got my pictures back.
Oh, good.
What'd the judge say?
He said he found out that Gallo was dead.
He found out. What'd he say?
Listen. I'm trying to think about the case now, okay? I'm sorry.
Can I help?
Can I help? No, you can't help. I wish you could, but you can't. Look how you're looking at me. Look how you... What does that look supposed to mean? I'm a piece of shit? Because I can't figure out a way for you to help? Okay, you know. We'll use your pictures. Ah, these are going to be... You know, I'm sorry, these are going to be at home. I should have looked at these pictures before. I like this. This is our first hotel room, right? That'll intimidate Trotter. Here's one of me from behind. And I didn't think I could feel worse than I did a couple of seconds ago. Thank you. Ah, here's a good one of the tire marks. Could we get any farther away? Where'd you shoot this, from up in a tree? What's this over here? What? It's dog shit. Dog shit, that's great. Dog shit, what a clue. Why didn't I think of that? Here's one of me reading, terrific. I should have asked you a long time ago for these pictures. Holy shit. You got it, honey. You did it. The case cracker. Me in the shower. I love this. That's it.
That is it. I'm out of here.
Lisa. Lisa. Sorry. Fuck. I'm missing something.
I reconstructed the script during the final days before we started shooting to make sure that Vinny was at his lowest ebb at this point in the film. That it appears that the FBI expert has torpedoed any hopes that Vinny and the boys have, and that there was no way out of his predicament. It's a good device in any courtroom drama that it looks like there is no hope of the defense winning until the very last moment when they somehow pull it out of the hat. It creates more tension and more excitement. So instead of discovering the clue that was in the photographs at lunchtime, which was how it was in the original script, we decided that he wouldn't figure out the clue in those photographs until he was back in court and had finished his cross-examination of the FBI man. That was the last possible moment for him to discover the truth.
The witness can stand down. Counsel?
You'll see the same device used in courtroom dramas like The Verdict.
Mr. Gambini, your first witness.
Now here, at the last possible moment, the prosecution's case, he sees something in these photographs which is a clue. We don't know what the clue is yet. We just know, from the shooting and from the music, that he's discovered something vital.
Please, can I have a 5-minute recess? My next witness is not in the courtroom right now.
3 minutes. No more.
Sheriff, do me a favor. Please trace this.
It's not my job. You do your own investigation.
Please, I only have 3 minutes.
And here we see Sheriff. The sheriff is Mr. Nice Guy. He's in fact interested in justice rather than in just winning. Something that regrettably happens all too seldom in real life.
I need the phone. We have to make up. Listen, let's make up, all right? We gotta go back inside. Everybody's waiting for us. Come on, we don't have a lot of time.
Please. Shut up.
Give me this. Fuck you! What is it with you with that mouth? Shut up! You know who you are.
Mr. Gambini.
How are you?
Tell me why.
And of course it was important to cut away after Tell Me Why, because we want to hold that information back from the audience until it's essential to give it to them. So now here comes a surprise. Lisa becomes the first witness.
This witness is an expert in the field of automobiles and is being called to rebut the testimony of George Wilbur.
Your Honor, would you please instruct the bailiff
officer
to escort Ms. Vito to the witness stand, please?
Hold up your right hand. Do you swear to tell the truth?
As the court case is going better, the rain outside has stopped and sunlight is now coming into the courtroom.
Ms. Vito, you're supposed to be some kind of expert in automobiles, is that correct? Is that correct?
Will you please answer the counselor's question?
No, I hate him.
Your Honor, may I have permission to treat Ms. Vito as a hostile witness?
You think I'm hostile? Now wait till you see me tonight.
Do you two know each other?
Yeah, she's my fiancée.
Well, that would certainly explain the hostility.
Your Honor, I object to this witness. Improper foundation. I'm not aware of this person's qualifications. I'd like to voir dire this witness as to the extent of her expertise.
Granted. Mr. Trotty may proceed.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Ms. Vito, what's your current profession?
I'm an out-of-work hairdresser.
Out-of-work hairdresser. Now, in what way does that qualify you as an expert in automobiles?
It doesn't.
Well, in what way are you qualified?
Well, my father was a mechanic. His father was a mechanic. My mother's father was a mechanic. My three brothers are mechanics. Four uncles on my father's side are mechanics.
Vito, your family's obviously qualified. But
the crowd that is getting bigger on each day of the trial in the courtroom are also local people recruited from the town to be extras for the movie.
What'd you do in your father's garage?
Tune-ups, oil changes, brake relining, engine rebuilds, rebuilt some trannies, rear ends.
Okay, okay. But does being an ex-mechanic necessarily qualify you as being an expert on tire marks?
No. Thank you. Goodbye.
Sit down and stay there until you're told to leave.
Your Honor, Ms. Vito's expertise is in general automotive knowledge. It is in this area that her testimony will be applicable. Now, if Mr. Trotter wishes to voir dire a witness as to the extent of her expertise in this area, I'm sure he's going to be more than satisfied.
Okay.
All right. Now, Ms. Vito, being an expert on general automotive knowledge, can you tell me what would the correct ignition timing be on a 1955 Bel Air Chevrolet with a 327 cubic inch engine and a four-barrel carburetor?
A bullshit question.
Does that mean that you can't answer it?
It's a bullshit question. It's impossible to answer.
Impossible because you don't know the answer.
Nobody could answer that question.
Your Honor, I move to disqualify Ms. Vito as an expert witness.
Can you answer the question?
No. It is a trick question.
Why is it a trick question?
Watch this.
Because Chevy didn't make a 327 in 55. The 327 didn't come out till 62. And it wasn't offered in the Bel Air with a four-barrel carb till 64. However, in 1964, the correct ignition timing would be 4 degrees before top dead center.
Well, she's acceptable, Your Honor.
So many of the laughs in this film are the reaction shots. The way people react to each other, the way she reacts to the judge, the way the judge reacts to her, the way Vinny reacts to her testimony. Much of comedy is in reaction, not necessarily in who is saying the line or doing the action.
Ms. Vito, did you take this picture?
You know I did.
And what is this picture of?
You know what it's of.
Ms. Vito, it has been argued by me, the defense, that two sets of guys met up at the Sack of Suds
at the same time, driving identical metallic mint green 1964 Buick Skylark convertibles. Now, can you tell us, by what you see in this picture, if the defense's case holds water? Ms. Vito, please answer the question. Does the defense's case hold water?
No. The defense is wrong.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
How could you be so sure?
Because there is no way that these tire marks were made by a 64 Buick Skylark. These marks were made by a 1963 Pontiac Tempest.
Objection, Your Honor. Can we clarify to the court whether the witness is stating opinion or fact?
This is your opinion?
It's a fact.
I find it hard to believe that this kind of information could be ascertained simply by looking at a picture.
Would you like me to explain?
I would love to hear this.
So would I.
The car that made...
There were a few scenes that we shot that were cut from the movie. Principally, they involved what was perceived in prep as a giant hole in the plot, which is that Bill phones his mother from the sheriff's station when he's first arrested. His mother sends Vinny down to the Deep South to defend him, but his mother never comes to the trial. What kind of an Italian mother, it was argued by certain people at the studio, what kind of an Italian mother would not show up at the trial in Alabama to give moral support to her son? Well, that was a tough question, because the answer is mother ought to have been there, but there, she would just have been a damn nuisance. The script was already long enough. We had to cut it a great deal to get it down to this length of just under 2 hours. And we certainly didn't want to introduce another character who had no other plot function. So we wrote some scenes in which the moment Vinny said he was going to go down there, or the moment Vinny screwed up for the first time, Mother had a heart attack. And we had Bill trying to keep in touch with Mother in hospital and getting messages. And there were a couple of scenes to do with Mother's heart attack. We never saw her. When we started putting the film together in the cutting room, it was just obvious that these scenes were going to be in the way of the momentum of the film. And we said, why don't we just try leaving them out and see if anyone notices that Mother never shows up. Nobody ever noticed. So we took those scenes out and saved between 5 and 10 minutes of stuff that we really didn't need. I suppose the conclusion of that is that a lot of the development of scripts is chasing down the logic of the story. People are concerned about what Hitchcock called the milk in the refrigerator syndrome, or words to that effect. In other words, when you come out of the movie and you've enjoyed it, and you go home and you're in your kitchen, you open the fridge and you're getting a glass of milk and a cookie before you go to bed, and you say to yourself, yes, but wait a minute, why wasn't Mother there? So a great deal of time is spent when you develop a script in trying to get all the logical points argued. Sometimes, however, that can truly get in the way of the artistry of the film. And there's no predicting whether an audience will notice that kind of a logical error, or they won't. Sometimes they do, and you have to deal with it. Sometimes they don't, and you can get away with it. And the only way you discover is to put it in front of an audience and test it. When the audience responds to the questionnaires that you give them, was there anything that didn't make sense, you discover. And if after 2 or 3 screenings nobody mentions it, you know it's not a problem.
And is there any way in the world the Buick that the defendants were driving made those tire tracks? Come on, you could say it's okay, I know.
Actually, no.
No. Thank you. No more questions. Your Honor, I call Sheriff Farley.
You may stand down now, Mr. Wilbur. Sheriff, you realize you're still under oath?
Yes, sir. Sheriff Farley, what'd you find out?
On a hunch. I took it upon myself to check out if there was any information on a 63 Pontiac Tempest stolen or abandoned recently. This computer readout confirms that two boys who fit the defendant's description were arrested 2 days ago by Sheriff Tillman in Jasper County, Georgia, for driving a stolen metallic mint green 1963 Pontiac Tempest with a white convertible top, Michelin model XGV tires, size 75R14.
Is that it?
No. A .357 Magnum revolver was found in their possession.
Sheriff Farley, just to refresh the court's memory, what caliber bullet was...
So at this point, the film follows the conventions of courtroom drama by coming up with who actually did commit the crime, even though we never meet them. We know that the mystery has been solved.
Your Honor, in light of Miss Vito's and Mr. Wilbur's testimony, the state like dismiss all charges.
Get out of here by three. Make sure all the bags are in the car. Yeah, bring it around.
I'm sorry to have ever doubted you at any time. And for this, I apologize. I mean, under the circumstances, you're great. And I just want to say thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I hope we can do it again sometime.
Fine job, Mr. Gambini.
Thanks.
Y'all come back and see us any time now.
I'll see you. I'll see you.
Then, no.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Then I...
Tony, take your time, pick the right words, get back to New York, give me a call. Okay.
Benny, you did a terrific job.
Thanks.
Now listen, I want you to know you got an open invitation anytime you want to come down here. Hell, we'll get us a deer next time.
Okay, thanks a lot. I feel like if I don't get out of here now, I might never be able to leave.
Mr. Gambini,
I have a fax here from the clerk of New York. I owe you an apology, sir. I'm honored to shake your hand. Win some, lose some. Your courtroom manner may be rather unconventional, but I gotta tell you, you're one hell of a trial lawyer.
Thank you, and you're one hell of a judge. Oh, sorry.
Bye now.
Bye. What the hell was that all about back there?
I had a friend send a fax to the judge confirming the very impressive legal stature of Jerry Hallow.
What friends you got in the clerk's office?
Your friend.
My friend.
Judge Malloy. So what's your problem?
My problem is I wanted to win my first case without any help from anybody.
Well, I guess that plan's moot.
Yeah.
You know, this could be a sign of...
So this scene, Lisa reveals herself as the mastermind. Not only is she the expert on cars, she's also the one that fooled the judge into thinking that Vinny was a real lawyer with a long track record. And we see that she is, in fact, the smartest character in the movie, if we didn't know that already.
Well,
not going to marry me now?
No way. Can't win a case by yourself. You're fucking useless.
And they go off into the sunset, as it were. They ride off into the sunset, still arguing, still fighting, and still, obviously, in love with each other. And in love with the whole notion of argument. Well, thank you for listening. And I hope you enjoyed watching it as much as we enjoyed making it.
She wanted him for marriage, but the torch that she carried was hotter than the fires of hell. But he said he didn't need her, since she followed him down deep into the buckle of the Bible bed. She begged and she pleaded, and she told him all she needed was a little tender love and care. But he was wrapped up in his work and acting like a jerk by pretending that she wasn't there. But her heart was love-stricken, so she never thought of quitting or giving up on how she felt. She had plans to reduce him, and she could, she would lose him a notch in the Bible bed. There's a lot of good people who are led astray that believe through love and death. But I'll tell you something, brother, when you're dealing with your feet, it's tough to keep a level head. Cancer, so you're gonna have to answer to your heart in the Bible bed. Finally made.